Welcome to CDH's Conversations podcast. My name is Brigitte Mangale, and I'm a director in the pro bono and human rights practice based in Cape Town. My practice's core focus is women's rights, and I'm privileged to be able to drive strategic and impact litigation and project work that positively supports women and girls across the country. We share this podcast in honor of International Women's Day, observed across the world on the 8th of March each year, and as part of CDH's Women Empowerment series. I have the pleasure of discussing important issues affecting women with some of our female powerhouses based in CDH's South African and Kenyan offices. My first guest, Lucinda Rudy, a director in our Cape Town dispute resolution practice and in the corporate debt, turnaround and restructuring sector. Lucinda has vast experience in complex commercial litigation matters, corporate debt, turnaround and restructuring, Companies Act litigation matters and disputes, financial markets and market abuse litigation and corporate investigations. Lucinda is involved in major high court litigation matters, as well as complex domestic and international commercial arbitrations. My next guest, Lebohang Mabidikane, a director in our competition law practice based in Johannesburg. Lebohang has extensive experience in evaluating the competitive and public interest effects of mergers, conducting investigations of cartel and abuse of dominance conduct, assessing exemption applications, and leading search and seizure operations. She's also provided training and commentary to other African competition regulators and provided input on the legislative framework for and enforcement of competition law in several other African jurisdictions. My third guest, Annie Bezaidnote, is a director in our employment law practice based in Cape Town. Annie has advised both local and international clients on all aspects of South African employment law. Annie specializes in individual labor law and has vast experience in assisting clients with employment-related due diligences for the purpose of potential mergers and acquisitions. My fourth and final guest, Lydia Orwur, a partner in our real estate law practice based in our Nairobi office. She's a highly experienced advocate of the High Court of Kenya with more than 10 years of experience. She specializes in conveyancing, property law, and documentation and review of bank securities. She also serves as a valuable member of the Law Society of Kenya's editorial committee mandated to originate proposals on the reform of the law and practice in relation to conveyancing, property law, and environmental law. A very warm welcome to you all, and thank you for joining me. The legal industry in Africa is changing. For a long time, men dominated the field, while women had to work twice as hard just to be seen and heard. But that's shifting. Women are stepping up, breaking barriers, and taking on leadership roles as lawyers, corporate advisors, policymakers, and judges. They're proving that gender should never be a barrier to success. But even with progress, significant challenges remain. Women are still underrepresented in top legal positions. They face pay gaps, fewer leadership opportunities, and unconscious bias. This isn't just unfair, it's a wasted opportunity. Law firms and businesses benefit when women's voices and perspectives are part of decision-making. More diverse leadership means smarter, more inclusive solutions for clients and society. It's time to take real action. Women should not only enter the legal profession, but thrive in it. This means equal access to opportunities, mentorship, and career growth. Law firms, companies, and policymakers must work together to break down barriers and make gender diversity the norm, not the exception. And so that's where this podcast comes in. Accelerate Action, the State of Gender Equality in the African Legal Sector, will explore what's changing, what still needs to change, and how we can make real progress. Picking up from last year's conversation, our panel of legal professionals will share their experiences, insights, and ideas for the future. To kick off our conversation, I start with you, Lucinda. What are some of the key legal strategies that women entrepreneurs in Africa can use to recover and sustain their businesses during economic uncertainty? And how can the legal sector accelerate action to support them?
Thank you, Brigitte. Yes, women are certainly emerging as a powerful force driving innovation and economic advancement as part of what we now see of Africa's entrepreneurship landscape. But, you know, these journeys, as you've mentioned, are often hampered by significant legal and regulatory barriers that impede their progress. Now, some legal strategies which women can use is to make sure, especially when they find themselves in different African countries, that they are aware of the legal and regulatory requirements applicable to their specific business venture. In this situation, knowledge really is power. You know, for instance, in many African countries, the process of business registration can be extremely cumbersome, very expensive, and very protracted. And it's important that women understand the process, understand the delays, understand the costs involved in it so that they can plan for it, also from a financial perspective. Luckily, there are a growing number of initiatives to empower female entrepreneurs. There are a lot of organizations supporting women-owned enterprises, which provides resources, including legal aid, entrepreneurship training, tailored mentorship programs. And those are the type of strategies that potential and current women entrepreneurs must seek out. They must seek out these organizations to assist them to sustain their business, especially during time where there is economic uncertainty. And from a legal sector perspective, it's important for law firms over the African continent to invest in these initiatives, collaborating with these organizations to provide workshops, training sessions, and really to empower women entrepreneurs during this journey.
Thank you very much for that, Lucinda. Lebohang, thank you for joining us. As a leader in a male-dominated environment, what challenges have you faced, and how can the legal sector accelerate action to create more equal opportunities for women in leadership?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I know that I've also experienced challenges in the, you know, in my professional journey, gender-related challenges. I mean, for instance, I was just thinking about an incident where a male lawyer, a counterpart of mine, was screaming at me over the phone, and another incident where another male attorney basically used a very condescending tone when speaking to me about work. And I know that this, he was doing that in a manner that he wouldn't have done so if I were a man. So certainly I've had my own experience of having these challenges just because I'm a female lawyer. But I think before we even think about what we can do to accelerate change, we need to think about the context in which our male counterparts find themselves in. And I think therein our solution will lie, right? Because the issue of patriarchy is a societal issue more than it is a professional issue. And how it finds its way into the workplace is simply because of the backgrounds that our male counterparts come from. Whether in South African society or the broader African society, we know that, you know, patriarchy is real, and the role of a woman is not described in the way that, you know, it fits a professional woman who's in an office and who's able to fend for themselves financially. So I think within the understanding of that background, then we need to look for our solutions to accelerate change and, you know, to create more opportunities for women. And that's why my first thinking is that, well, as a legal profession, for example, I think it's definitely critical that we invest in a lot of training for men, training that's actually meant to deconstruct what society teaches men about women, about gender roles, about equality, you know, because I don't think it's enough to simply, you know, concentrate on what happens in the office and just the profession. I think it's what's coming from society that's lending itself in the office. But more importantly, though, I think women in leadership are tasked and should, you know, be ready to create opportunities for themselves as well as those that come after them or those that come after us, right? And in that way, there's different ways of doing this. I mean, we cannot leave the agenda for women inclusion in the hands of men. Otherwise, the change is going to come quite slowly, if at all. So if you're asking me how we can accelerate the creation of opportunities for women, my answer would be to say, well, as leaders, people like myself and everybody else on this panel, we should be ready to mentor and assist junior women lawyers. And in our mentoring, we must be very intentional, you know, so we must be generous towards them. And in terms of patience and empathy and understanding, while we teach them what we know, ensuring that we pass on skill, whilst at the same time remaining quite sensitive to those challenges, which are really challenges that are generally only experienced by women lawyers and professionals.
Thank you so much for those insights, Lebohang, and for sharing your experiences. As horrific and extraordinarily inappropriate as they are, they're unfortunately not uncommon. And so, Anli, I turn to you as an employment lawyer to unpack more around what can be done by employers to uplift women in law and other industries. Do you believe companies in the legal sector are doing enough to support women? Or is there still a significant gap in terms of gender equality and opportunities for women in law?
So I think my colleagues have touched on similar themes in that for women to promote the rights of women, right? We need to be the spokesperson for what we think should be done or what is not right. So in relation to gender equality and opportunities for women in law, I believe the law firms are doing what they're being asked to do, and it's for us to make requests for what more we may need. What I mean by that is that there are simple measures that can be put in place by inclusion, for example. We have various regulatory bodies and forums in which you can include female voices for the better. I think there's definitely value to add there. And it's also supported by the underlying regulatory framework that that should be done. But then there's also the simple and what some would call the softer things that can be done, which is to acknowledge that women bring different qualities and attributes to the table and to lean into those. For example, women are often incredible negotiators and specifically conciliators, and to possibly use that as a means to nominate them for those types of positions. A further possible measure is to meet women where they are at, right? Each one has different goals and success looks different for everyone. And I think employers should stop assuming what women's family or social endeavors will look like. Each one has a different plan for a future, and questions surrounding family planning or marital status no longer has any place in the workplace. And in fact, our courts have held that it is for a family to decide who will be the main caregiver and not for society or for policy decisions. So we need to move away from questions or concerns and recruitment processes about what our female colleagues' family planning may look like or what our social endeavors may be, and accept that the current landscape allows for various different models and supports it and encourages it. And we also need to recognize that the importance and to celebrate women's achievements, because in highlighting our female counterparts, we're assisting in creating the path for other females to know that they can achieve similar goals. And that would make the law more accessible to juniors as well.
Thank you for that, Anlie. Lydia, having now heard some of the experiences in the South African context, although not limited to South Africa, we'd be grateful to hear from you on some of the lived realities of women in Kenya. How do legal frameworks in Kenya currently address land ownership rights for married women? And what more can be done to accelerate gender equality in that area?
Thank you so much, Brigitte. So the question is, how do legal frameworks in Kenya currently address land ownership rights for married women? I need to emphasize that. That means that we need to start by addressing the fundamental question, is your marriage properly anchored in the eyes of the law? Because the law can only protect you when you choose to stand within it. Now, the current position in Kenya is that registration of marriage with the Registrar of Marriages is a compulsory requirement for your marriage to meet all the legal requirements. Without registration, your marriage will not be recognized by law. And that means that the rights and obligations associated with the marriage will not be fully enforceable. That means that the emphasis there is that this must have implications for real estate, obviously, and property transactions that rely on spousal consent where required. So, of course, all this comes with a rider regarding communities governed by religious laws, such as Islamic marriages, for example. Now, Kenya's legal landscape has made significant strides in addressing land ownership rights for married women. We do have to acknowledge that. So we can start with equal rights in property ownership. The Constitution of Kenya, which was promulgated in the year 2010, number one, guarantees equal property rights for all, regardless of gender, which was a big win. The Constitution also encourages elimination of gender discrimination in land ownership, and that's under Article 60 of the Constitution. And the Constitution also called for progressive land reforms to enhance women's land rights. So the Constitution, therefore, has set a very good foundation for gender equality. But we also have the Matrimonial Property Act, which provides that where matrimonial property is acquired during marriage in the name of one spouse, there shall be a rebuttable presumption that the property is held in trust for the other spouse. And also, if the property is acquired in the names of the spouses jointly, there shall be a rebuttable presumption that their beneficial interest in the matrimonial property are equal. However, the same law, Matrimonial Property Act, provides that ownership of matrimonial property vests in spouses according to the contribution of either spouse towards its acquisition and shall be divided between the spouses if they divorce or if their marriage is otherwise dissolved. So we do have other pieces of legislation as well, such as the Law of Succession Act, which guarantees a widow's right to inherit property. We also have the Land Registration Act and the Land Act, which provide for joint tenancy. I know this may be a controversial take for those who are averse to joint tenancies, but the Land Acts do provide for joint tenancies, which simply mean equal ownership and the surviving spouse automatically inherits upon death of the other spouse. Also, regarding spousal interest in property, we have provisions under the Land Registration General Regulations that allow a spouse to apply for joint registration of property, even if it was initially in one name. That's important because when you carry out legal aid clinics, the revelation is that not so many people are aware of the provisions of the Land Registration Regulations. And another provision in these regulations is that a spouse can also just simply apply for registration of their interest in property. So the difference is that this does not confer ownership as opposed to the other provision. It only provides for recognition of interest. Now, in terms of what we can do to accelerate gender equality in this area, which is actually a good thing to reflect on, I would say we still need to deal with the gaps in enforcement. We also need to deal with the cultural barriers, which have survived the elaborate provisions of the Constitution. And we also need to deal with the systemic biases that still exist. Another key issue is how to prove non-monetary contribution. Remember when I was speaking on the Matrimonial Property Act, I mentioned that that law provides that ownership of matrimonial property vests in the spouses, but according to the contribution of either spouse towards its contribution. And contribution is defined to mean monetary contribution or non-monetary contribution. So how then do we prove non-monetary contribution? As we all know, women often struggle to prove non-monetary contributions. And this obviously makes equitable distribution of property difficult. So we do need to look into this. And I should also say, in terms of what we can do to accelerate justice, is that, you know, obviously there's the issue of awareness. And I think Lucinda also mentioned this. I also began by saying that the law can only protect you when you choose to stand within it. That means that sharing what we know regarding the legal framework can actually go a long way in empowering women to make informed decisions, right? The other thing that we can't ignore, obviously, is that access to justice is still costly and slow despite all the wins. So for women seeking to claim property, this is a big impediment despite the progressive laws. So we do need to provide an environment where access to justice is not costly and is not slow.
Lydia, you've shared a lot of helpful information and interesting information on legal frameworks in Kenya and the systems in place in that region. On that topic of legal framework, I turn back to you, Lucinda. How can legal frameworks across the African legal sector be improved to better support female business owners in accessing funding, contracts, and market opportunities, ultimately promoting gender equality?
Thanks, Brigitte, and thanks, Lydia. You know, it's all about empowering women entrepreneurs at the end of the day. And it's important that there must be collaboration between government and the private sector that could, for instance, lead, and I go back to what I discussed earlier, simpler registration procedures for businesses. Policies can be advocated for enhancing access to legal education, more favorable financing terms for women entrepreneurs. And one can even lobby and advocate for more legislative protection for women entrepreneurs by motivating and incentivizing larger businesses, government-owned entities, financial institutions to collaborate or to do business with women-owned businesses. And I think the legal fraternity and the legal sector plays a big role in facilitating these processes and advocating for these processes, specifically departments like yours, Brigitte. So it's not enough for us to stand back and say this is a political issue. From a legal sector, one must advocate and take part and collaborate in these endeavors.
Thanks for that, Lucinda. I think those are some helpful insights, and I want to keep pulling the thread of systems and frameworks and understanding that issue, because it's so helpful for women to understand the context in which they must operate, because that source of information is a source of empowerment in and of itself. So Anli, how can structured programs like learnerships, bursaries, and skills development initiatives specifically contribute to advancing women's careers within the legal sector? And then also, what practical steps would you say employers in the legal sector can take to create more meaningful opportunities for women, driving gender equality across our industry?
So in relation to structured programs like bursaries and learnerships, it very much ties in with Lucinda's response, is there's a possible solution in incentivizing employers specifically to create a focus group in relation to females. Alternatively, it's for employers themselves to undertake a value assessment and realize the true value that's being added to specifically in the legal sector, I believe, boardrooms by females, and to incentivize the recruitment of females and to prioritize that in their strategies going forward. For practical steps that employers in the legal sector can take to create more meaningful opportunities for women is quite simple, and CDH has adopted some of these already, and that's to create alternative career paths. Not every woman wants to be a main caregiver. Similarly, not every woman wants to work part-time and raise children. And I think the assumptions that are being applied by employers in recruiting females needs to be taken off the table. And recruitment strategies needs to be reviewed to ensure that people aren't excluded based on old assumptions about females specifically.
Thanks, Anli. You've made some interesting points about assumptions that are made, and you've hinted at some of the on-the-ground experiences of women. Back to you, Lucinda, to unpack more about some of the challenges that women experience. What common legal challenges would you say women entrepreneurs face in the African context? And how can they proactively address these issues to ensure long-term business continuity and gender parity?
You spoke earlier about the regulatory challenges which women entrepreneurs face. There's also, one must not forget, in the African context, cross-border and trade challenges that one needs to take account of. And it goes back to the first point that knowledge is power. So it's important for women entrepreneurs to do their research and to make sure that they understand these challenges. And as Anli rightly points out, women also face additional challenges, including operating in a male-dominated business environment and contending with traditional societal roles. I think Lydia enhanced that as well. So I think some important issues which women entrepreneurs, women in business can proactively address is to seek legal advice as soon and at the beginning, because it's important to determine the appropriate legal structure for your business. The different countries have different options on business formats, business entities, and it's important to do your research to make sure that you operate your business through a legal entity that will protect you and your personal estate as far as possible from liability. That, I think, is one of the most important things that woman needs to be aware of. One can never underestimate the role of well-drafted agreements. It's important that you consider before entering into any agreement, because of the male-dominated business environment, women often feel there's an imbalance of power when it comes to negotiating, but it's important for women to make sure that the agreements that they enter into, number one, that they understand it, that they take time to consider it, that they take the time to ask the questions if anything is uncertain, to make sure that you and your business are properly protected, that you negotiate the best terms available, and subject, of course, to everybody in the legal sector throughout the continent working towards better access to legal advice, legal services to make it more affordable. It's important for women entrepreneurs to seek legal guidance upfront as soon as possible to understand any possible risk that you may face and to plan to mitigate these risks as far as it's possible.
Thanks very much for that, Lucinda. We've heard now quite a bit about the experiences both of the panelists with us today and of their clients. And one hopes that lessons can come from those experiences. Lebohang, I turn back to you. What key lessons about leadership have you learned that could help accelerate gender equality in the African legal sector? And what advice would you offer to emerging female leaders? And then also, how can organizations in the African legal sector create more inclusive environments that empower women to take on leadership roles and drive gender equality across the industry?
So, you know, the consistent pursuit of excellence is a fundamental lesson that I've learned. After all, clients, you know, do not, or rather they should not brief you just because you're a woman or a man for that matter. This should be based on our expertise. So certainly we ought to be excellent at what we do. And this is advice I give to those who come after us to say that, you know, excellence is the only way for women to demand a seat at the table. You cannot demand to be treated equally when you don't measure up in terms of your expertise. And, you know, the other piece of advice that I'd give junior women lawyers is to find the right mentors. Mentorship is invaluable. I know that in my journey as a junior lawyer, I felt alone a lot of the time, and I took longer to deal with challenges that I would have otherwise dealt with much quicker if I had a more mature and experienced female voice guiding me along the way. So certainly excellence is the way to go. And even at my level, you know, I'm still, you know, learning as much as I can and trying to stretch myself in terms of my level of expertise. So the learning journey does not stop. It's even more critical, I think, as you get more senior as a woman lawyer, because what you want to do is to not stagnate and stay in the same place. You want to make sure that you get a seat at the table and you expand your horizons and, you know, you grow in the profession. And when it comes to, you know, how the African legal sector can create more inclusive environments that empower women in respect of leadership. I think the important thing that I've learned is that listening is such a rare character, you know, being able to be a good listener as an employer. It's something special, it's important, but it's quite rare. So my thinking is that, you know, these organizations ought to listen without judgment, and having listened, to act. I've heard of so many stories where women have told their employers about the challenges they face as women, you know, and because the employers are male, these, you know, challenges and these cries for help go unheard, they go unnoticed. And where people are, you know, are purporting to be listening, these challenges are minimized or ignored. So the reality is that we generally, in my view, have a fraternity, a legal fraternity that doesn't listen, mainly because it's dominated by men. So listening is very critical. And because of this inability to listen without judgment, some women actually don't even speak up anymore. They just die inside and they leave the legal profession, especially in practice. And we've observed, I mean, in the statistics, particularly in South Africa, where a lot of females leave practice because, you know, these types of challenges are not addressed. So they feel like they've got no other option but to actually leave the profession. So it's key for employers to listen with sincerity, without judgment, and then act in order to rectify or support these female lawyers who may need any form of support or that are challenged by some of these inappropriate things that are happening and require that be rectified.
Thank you, Lebohang. That's some really helpful guidance as to how we take steps towards equality. My last two questions are for you, Lydia. Pulling the thread of equality and understanding more about the Kenyan context, in your view, how can legal protections for married women regarding land ownership be strengthened to ensure both financial security and gender equality? And then what role can the legal sector play in advancing women's land rights and overall gender equality in property ownership? And what steps can we take to accelerate these changes?
This is a very good conversation that we are having. And thank you for those questions, Brigitte. So let me begin by saying that the law at its best should be a shield, not a test. That should be the standard. the law should protect before harm occurs, rather than, you know, the law serving as a remedy after damage is done. Even so, for many married women, land ownership remains a fight and not a given, which is a problem. The legal frameworks in Kenya have made commendable strides toward gender equality in property rights, and we do acknowledge that. But the reality is very clear. Having laws on paper does not always translate into protection in practice. If we are to accelerate action toward financial security and gender equality, we must move from passive recognition to active enforcement. We must move from conditional ownership to indisputable rights. And as I said earlier, I hold the view that one of the biggest injustices in Kenya's Matrimonial Property Act is actually the requirement that women should prove their contribution to matrimonial property acquisition in marriage. Imagine that. In a society where women handle domestic labor, a large percentage of women actually do handle domestic labor and childcare and emotional labor. None of this is financial. None of this can be financially quantified. So that provision can actually be disadvantageous in that way. I don't know, perhaps from a Kenyan perspective, given the laws that we currently have, it may be beneficial to shift to a presumption of joint ownership of matrimonial property unless there's clear evidence to the contrary. But obviously, this can be explored further. I do strongly feel that that provision can actually work towards disempowering women who that piece of legislation intended to protect. The other thing I'd like to say is that legal protections are only as powerful as the ability to enforce them. I think that's actually self-explanatory. But because in many communities, customary beliefs still override statutory law. Women are discouraged from claiming land, even to date. And they're often told that the land belongs to the men because, unfortunately, that's the society we are in. So even when they win in court, family and community resistance can make enforcement of their win in court very difficult. In my view, the main solution I can propose here is to strengthen public awareness, right? We need to strengthen public awareness campaigns about women's land rights, especially at the grassroots level, because that's where the impact is felt. In terms of what role can the legal sector play in advancing women's land rights and overall gender equality, I wish to suggest two things. Number one, I propose that we could expand our pro bono legal services. I know we are in a space that is quite busy, and we barely have time to do pro bono work, but we need to do pro bono work. We need to expand pro bono legal services and land clinics for women facing property disputes. The other thing I'd like to propose is that we need to strengthen alternative dispute resolution. And I know there may be a rejoinder to this. There may be people who feel that alternative dispute resolution mechanisms may not serve the purpose that they're intended to serve. But I do strongly feel that if we strengthen alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, it will allow faster and less costly resolution of land cases. Because generally, women should not have to choose between justice and survival. That would just be my humble submission. Overall, lawyers and policymakers in this regard have the power to drive gender equality in land ownership, right? So what can we do? Legal reforms, advocacy, we can increase representation of women in property and leadership in law. There's all manner of options that we can adopt towards achieving equality in land ownership in Kenya. Thank you so much.
Once again, some really helpful guidance from you, Lydia. Thank you. And thank you all for your valuable contributions. The insights shared in this podcast aimed to elevate the importance of continued advocacy and reform in the legal sector to create a more inclusive and equitable future. By accelerating action, we can help shape a legal profession where gender equality is not just an aspiration, but a reality. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to keeping this conversation going by hearing from more of CDH's female powerhouses in the near future.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.